Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Mark Goodyear. Welcome to the Classic Album Club podcast. In this episode, we revisit Primal Scream's mystifying 1991 album, Screamadelica.
I knew quite early on that people were being affected by it very intensely. Music was our life, going to clubs was our life. But really, we were, you know, young artists. We were living in the moment and we were sincere about what we were doing, and we really believed in rock and roll, and we really believed that we wanted to redeem rock and roll.
We'll be hearing from frontman Bobby Gillespie about the acid house origins of the album and how the band adapted to their distinctive new sound.
We were writing with keyboards. Moving On Up was written on the keyboard. Till Fight Feel It, Higher Than the Sun, Inner Flight. We were using way more minor chords, kind of moving away from like blues-based rock and roll, and maybe going somewhere more melodic and maybe a gentler place.
First, Bobby Gillespie tells us how a remix of an old Primal song started them on the path to forging one of the albums of the decade.
The guy who'd played guitar on the first album, Jim Beattie, had left, and Robert Young moved from bass to guitar. Andrew Ennis joined on guitar. Everything got a little bit heavier, you know. They were playing Les Pauls through Marshall amps, and there was a kind of MC5, Stooges, New York Dolls, Johnny Thunders, Heartbreakers, a huge influence on the sound. I guess we just wanted to have fun and play high energy rock and roll music. And, you know, we toured that record. It wasn't a big record. The band, we weren't really a successful band in terms of, you know, record sales or, you know, playing big venues and stuff. We were still playing like pubs and stuff, and you know, our clubs, discos, you know, most that would come to see would be like 500 people or something in London, you know, and you'd do 300 or something up in Leicester or Derby, you know, 400, 500, you know, but it wasn't big. But those years, 88, 89, you had the acid house explosion here in the UK, and we got involved in that. We began going to parties. Friends of ours started buying the records and telling us that we should check it out. And there was some resistance at first, but slowly, and I think through use of the drug ecstasy, we became seduced, and we made friends in that world, notably Andrew Weatherall, who was a DJ, but he also wrote for a club fanzine called Boyzone. And Andy, in the summer of 1989, had put, you know, in his column, he was asked, you know, favourite records that, you know, that he was listening to at that point. And everybody else was writing about, you know, acid house records and club records. And he wrote the ballads from, all the ballads from the second Primal Scream album. So he was kind of like the only guy, writer in Britain, who said that they liked Primal Scream. And so we asked him to remix one of the tracks from our second album, and he remixed I'm Losing More Than I'll Ever Have, and then that song became the dub version of that we called Loaded. And then Andy had a white label, and wherever he played it, in clubs all over the country, it would detonate the club. People would go crazy. Then it became an underground hit, a club hit, and then it got on the charts. So that was the first track of Screamadelica, was Loaded. It was like a dub version, you know. We grew up in, you know, we were into dub versions of reggae songs when we were punks. You know, we loved African Dub Chapter 3, the album by Joe Gibbs and The Professionals, which was dub versions, reworkings of, like, you know, Jamaican hit singles in Jamaica, like vocal tracks. So we didn't even know the vocal tracks, we just knew the dub versions, so, and the deconstructions. So it was just great to have like a dub version of one of your songs, and great that people were dancing to it in clubs. But, you know, like the bass, the percussion, the strings, the horns, that was all from I'm Losing More, you know. So, yeah, it felt like a record. Before Loaded was officially released, I got a phone call one night at 4 in the morning, and I was sitting up playing records or reading or something, you know, or watching a film or something, and I got a phone call. It was Andrew Innes, guitarist and screaming. He was very excited, and he said, "I've just been to Subterranea in West London. Weatherall was DJing. He played Loaded. The place went bananas, you know. It just, like I said before, it detonated the place, you know." He said everybody went crazy. And he said Kevin Rowlands from Dexys and Mick Jones from The Clash, BAD, came up and they were shaking his hand saying, "What a great record, man, what a great record." And Kevin and Mick are two of our heroes, you know, so I was obviously flattered by that. But he was just like, it was a feeling that we were going to have a hit record, you know. We'd been going to those clubs and really digging the sounds that we heard and you know, enjoying the drugs and enjoying just the culture, and everybody was friendly. And, you know, that's where the energy was in the late 80s. It was an acid house. It wasn't a rock music. Rock music, as far as we were concerned, was dead. It was defunct. It had lost everything that made it vital in the first place, you know. And the energy was with acid house. And to have your record played in one of those clubs and see everybody dancing and going crazy, you know, it was like a real live moment where you felt you were part of the culture, you know, part of the greater culture. So that was exciting. Yeah, I loved that.
The band's heavy involvement with the acid house scene proved pivotal in the change in sound that would dominate the new record.
We were writing with keyboards. Moving On Up was written on the keyboard. To Fight Feel It, Higher Than the Sun, Inner Flight, I Think I'm Coming Down, Damaged, and Come Together were written on guitar. Shine Like Stars was written on the keyboard. We were using way more minor chords and using, I think, major sevenths and stuff. You know, more kind of singer-songwriter, kind of LA late 60s, early 70s kind of feel, you know. Kind of moving away from like blues-based rock and roll and maybe going somewhere more melodic and maybe a gentler place. Still kind of dark as well, you know, and maybe slightly melancholic. Alan McGee put us on a wage, and I think it was £70 a week. I was still getting housing benefit because the weekly wage was not enough. We built a little studio in Hackney before it became fashionable. We had to build a room within a room to soundproof it. It was on a very small industrial estate next to a block of council flats. And so we had to be quiet. And because we were working late at night as well, we'd start at 5, 6 at night and work till 10 in the morning or whatever. And we bought an S1000 sampler and a keyboard, and we began sampling and writing songs on to drum loops, you know, on keyboards. And as I say, Moving On Up, Don't Fight, Feel It, Higher Than the Sun, Shine Like Stars, they were written in that style. We kind of kept late hours. I think we got up late and we went to bed late. Not because we were always partying, but because that was just, in my case, a protest against industrial working hours. I just, you know, I didn't want to be constrained by get up at 7 or 6, be at work for 8. I just wanted to be, maybe live a more bohemian kind of existence where I was looser with my arrangements, shall we say. And I just liked the night time because it was quiet and I could think, could read and listen to music. And even if you went out in the streets, there was no one around, and I liked that.
The album opener, Moving On Up, mixing the bluesy rock and roll of the Rolling Stones with a repeating house drum loop, signposted this change in direction for the band.
The demo was, I had piano, vocal piano, and maybe it might have been a drum loop in there. It might have been a bit slower, but I think what was missing was it needed a hook. We had the song, but we needed a signature hook at the beginning. And Andrew Innes had the idea of the Magic Bus guitar, the Bo Diddley guitar. As soon as we had that idea, we knew exactly what we wanted to do with the track. You know, it suddenly had propulsion, had direction, and had the rhythm that it needed, you know. Before that, it was just like, it was a really nice song, nice piano, you know, nice melody, and but it had no high energy rock and roll thing. I think Andrew's guitar gave it the rock and roll. We recorded Moving On up at the studios in Jam Studios in Crouch End with Colin Leggett and Jimmy Miller mixed it, and we recorded the gospel choir and stuff. We did all that stuff. But we recorded lots and lots and lots of tracks. And Jimmy was really good at kind of sorting that out, you know, and leaving stuff out that was unneeded, you know. And that's what the producer's there for, you know, to help you sort out the chaos of the recording. Being immersed in Acid House, we're going to clubs and we were hearing, you know, every record it was a bit groove, you know, and we were listening to a lot of black music, a lot of 60s soul, a lot of funk, all about the groove. And, you know, for me, I've always been attracted to music that had the big, you know, the big beat, whether it be like Elvis's Sun Sessions or James Brown or Donna Summer or The Stones or, you know, New York Dolls or Stooges. There's a primal beat, you know, savage beat, Link Ray's got it. The kind of rock and roll I like has got the big beat. Because of the technology, you could, even if you didn't have a funky drummer, you could sample Funky Drummer by James Brown or sample The Meters, you know, Ziggy Modalist. And you could, even if you never used those drums in your track, you could write a song to that beat and that rhythm, and it would give a direction, a certain feel and direction to the song, you know. I mean, it's like, for instance, we did a version of Shine Like Stars that was faster, which was kind of based on Joy by Isaac Hayes. There was some funk guitar that Andrew Innes put on that was kind of very influenced by Rock Your Baby by George McRae. We recorded a version of that up at the studio in Crouch End, Jam Studio. But one day we turned up for work and the studio was closed. And the mixing desk, the engineer, was there. One of the guys that worked there and said, the mixing desk is gone. All the tapes are gone. All the outboard equipment's gone. And what had happened was that the guy who owned it was in a lot of debt and he disappeared as well. So some of the tapes had gone. One of the tapes that went missing was Shine Like Stars. I secretly was very happy about that because I felt that we should have, it wasn't working. And we even got the Orb to do a mix of it. And it was just too fast and it didn't really suit the funk approach. And so we went to Eden Studios in Chiswick and we recorded it and we slowed it down and got Martin Duffy to play harmonium. And that's the version that's on Screamin' Delica.
Producer and hitmaker Andrew Weatherall brought a distinctive influence to the album, which can be clearly heard on their cover of the 13 Floor Elevators song, Slip Inside This House.
It's an Andy Weatherall mix. Weatherall and Hugo Nicholson were like the rhythm section on that track. And the piano was Martin Duffy, the sitar, the electric choral sitar is Robert Young, you know. In fact, Robert Young sings this song. I wasn't very well. It was although it was the summer of 1990, I was sick. I had terrible fever. I somehow managed to come up from Brighton to London, but did a couple of passes on the vocal, and then I collapsed. And Robert Young took over vocal duties. He sang it really well, and it's the only song he ever sang. The guy who wrote the lyrics was a guy called Tommy Hall, who was a bit older than the rest. I think he felt that LSD could maybe change the world for the better. And we were kind of immersed in like 60s counterculture thinking, and there was definitely some parallels that I could see. People like Happy Mondays would get Paul Oakenfold to do mixes, and then those mixes became like anthems, you know, like WFL and Hallelujah, and they were just the best records of that time. Or like, you know, that's how we first came across, you know, we heard, oh, Weatherall did a mix for Happy Mondays, maybe he could do a mix for us. It was a very punk approach because these guys were DJs. They knew but worked on the dance floor, but they hadn't been in studios before. They didn't know the rules, and we found that very attractive. To my mind, we wanted to write an anthem. Like we loved like Northern Soul, and we loved Motown, and you know, we loved Stax and Muscle Shoals. We wanted to make a dance floor anthem, but you know, in a modern way. And so we wrote Don't Fight You Feel It, and wanted to write an anthem. It was a celebration of going out and dancing and then having a good time through ecstasy culture. That was Don't Fight You Feel It. But I didn't feel that the song that we wrote, I didn't feel that I had the vocal range to really do justice to the song. So we asked Denise Johnson, because we'd heard Denise singing with a band called Hypnotone, and we saw them play at the club was called Solaris. And so we went along and heard her singing. said, would you let us sing in this song, you know? So she came down to like a EMI's demo studio, which was in Tottenham Court Road, because we were signed to EMI Publishing. She sang, you know, and I sat in the control room, sang my ideas to her, and she sang some of my ideas, and then she put a lot of herself in it, you know, and she sang it beautifully. And then Andy Weatherall did these three incredible mixes, which he had on a white label that he would play in the clubs, and people would go insane for it, you know. And we wanted that to be the single after Come Together, and we wanted that as a single in autumn, winter 1990, but Alan McGee said it's too extreme, because you, Bob, you're the focal point of the band, you're the singer, but you weren't unloaded. McGee thought it was just too far out at that point, and he possibly was right, you know, because he just said people are not going to understand us.
Screamadelica was beginning to take shape, and in early 1991, the band relocated to Jam Studios in Crouch End to record the rest of the album, coming up in this episode of Classic Album Club.
If you can capture that soulfulness and just the way you feel, whether it's an ecstatic feeling, an angry feeling, a sexual feeling, a sad feeling, if you can get that feel in your music, you're getting somewhere, you know, because other people can relate to that. They relate to the feeling. The feeling is beyond words, and it's beyond chords, and it's beyond the rhythm. It's the feeling, because of the technology that people could sample stuff in a way that they couldn't do it before, and it was like making a musical poetry, you know, when the only limit was the limits to your imagination, and it was just what everybody was doing. It was a culture. I first met Paul Cannell in Clerkenwell Road. I just liked the guy right away. I liked the drawing that he did on Phobia. It was just like a little paranoid creature, weird, shriveled up, angry, intense character. And I don't know, I just get the idea that maybe he could do something for us.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The song Damaged highlights the diversity that ran through the album and brought the soulful emphasis that Bobby was after.
When we recorded it live, and I think we had maybe Henry Olsen played stand-up bass in it. Martin Duffy plays beautiful country soul keyboards. We were always trying to get a feel. That's what we're about, get a feel. The way that, say, we feel inside ourselves. You want to get that in the music. That's the art, you know, capturing that feeling. Because if you can capture that soulfulness and just the way you feel, whether it's an ecstatic feeling, an angry feeling, a sexual feeling, a sad feeling, if you can get that feel in your music, you're getting somewhere, you know, because other people can relate to that. They relate to the feeling. The feeling is beyond words, and it's beyond chords, and it's beyond the rhythm. It's the feeling. That's what I think is wrong with so much contemporary music. It has got no feeling. Personally, I was really into the Midnight Cowboy soundtrack and Superfly by Curtis Mayfield. And on the Curtis Mayfield album, there's a track called Think, which is instrumental. And I always loved that track. And I remember thinking, it'd be great to have an instrumental track on an album, something really beautiful like this. That just, no words, just, you know, pure music. And you could just take you on a trip somewhere, you know. You could just, it's open, you know, to interpretation. And so I guess Inner Flight grew from that wish, you know, that desire.
Along with live instrumentation, Bobby and the band took advantage of recent developments in sampling technology.
It was just the times, you know. I think everything was up for grabs, and because of the technology that people could sample stuff in a way that they couldn't do it before, and it was, you know, like rap records were doing it, you know, hip-hop records were doing it, house records were doing it, you know, dance records. You know, it was like, the Wild West, you know, no copyright laws. I think people were just making records because it, you know, doing sampling because it was new, it was fun, it was like a well, it was like the equivalent of William Burroughs's cut up method, where you cut up whole texts from old books and then you reassemble it and then you suddenly have a new sense and you can write a new poem. You know, it was like a, making a musical poetry, you know. You know, when the only limit was the limits to your imagination. And we were just, it was just what everybody was doing. It was a culture.
Another striking feature of the album was the cover, which was inspired by the work of Creation Records in-house artist Paul Cannell.
I first met Paul Cannell in Clerkenwell Road. He had been doing artworks for a band called Flared Up, who'd released a record called Phobia on Heavenly Records, I think. And Jeff Barrett, the guy who was the leader of the Heavenly, was at that point our press officer. And I just liked the guy right away. And I liked the sort of drawing that he did on Phobia. It was just like a little paranoid creature, weird, shriveled up, angry, intense character. And I don't know, I just get the idea that maybe he could do something for us. So starting with Higher Than the Sun, I went to see him and I saw some of his paintings and I thought, okay, I'm going to give you a song title. It's called Higher Than the Sun and I want you to do a painting. And from that painting, I'm going to make a record sleeve. Now, Cannell wanted to hear the lyrics and he wanted to hear the song. I wouldn't let him hear either because I wanted him just to do a painting from his imagination. If he heard the music or the lyric, it would maybe could be too literal, and I did not want literal. I wanted abstract. I went back a few weeks later, and he called me up and said, okay, I've got a painting, come see it. So he had this bedroom stroke studio that he, and he canvases all over the place on the floor. You know, just pure creativity everywhere, chaos and creativity. That's how I would describe his scene and how I would describe Cannell, his character. He had this beautiful painting. So then I had a guy called Grant Fleming come to photograph it. And from those photographs, I took sections. I made a section for the Higher Than the Sun sleeve for the front cover. And then I did a detail from that. I would take details from the main painting. And then I would use a detail for the front cover of a 12-inch single and a 7-inch. And then I would take a larger detail of that and make that the back sleeve. So there was two 12-inches for Higher Than the Sun. So out of those two 12-inches, especially the second 12-inch, there's a sun motif that's in the painting. It's part of the larger abstract painting. That image was used as an advert for a dealer poster for independent record shops because at that point, Creation was still a truly independent record label. I think it was distributed by the cartel and through Rough Trade. And so maybe the dealer poster was like red, and it might have had like a white sun emblem. It was quite basic because they never had a lot of money. I did the same for Don't Fight Philip. He did a painting, same process, gave him the title. And we did two 12 inches for that. And we did a short tour of some UK dates, Glasgow, London, Nottingham, maybe Norwich, Bristol. We did about 5 or 6 dates. And a few days after the London gig, about 2 days after, I had to go to the Creation office and I saw Alan McGee and he was like, the album's ready to go, we need the sleeve. So somehow, I think it was McGee said, what about that sun idea? You know, it's recurring, it's a good image. And so I took the sun idea and I went to see, I don't even remember the guy's name, he was a graphic designer. So I think it was in Putney. And we took the kind of sun idea, put it in a computer and then started messing around with the colours. And I chose these colours. And I cropped it exactly the way you see it in the sleeve. And then I didn't want any writing in the cover. You know, I thought I liked albums like Joy Division and New Order, the Peter Saville factory designs where there's no writing. Did the back like Changes One Bowie, tribute to David Bowie. And chose a Grant Fleming photograph for the gatefold sleeve. No writing, there's no writing anywhere. And the song titles inside on the labels, there's nothing anywhere. It's just the music. And it says who produced it. Everything was minimal for a reason. That was part of the idea, that it would just be like this really powerful image. It's a damaged sun, and I'm a damaged sun. And that only came to me a couple of years back. You know, I was thinking, I knew there was symbolism in this image, you know. There was, but Kinnell was a damaged son. He died 2005. And so he had a lot of problems with drugs. And he was a really beautiful, beautiful man. And sad that he's not around, you know. And he never lived to see this image become a stamp. And he was an anarchist, so it would have been quite an irony for him to see the Queen's head on a stamp, you know, beside Led Zeppelin 4 and Pink Floyd and London Calling by the Clash. It was a great moment, you know.
Perhaps the song that best represents the true ethos of Screamadelica is the penultimate track, Higher Than the Sun, a dub symphony in two parts, which included more evocative Andrew Weatherall production, alongside a cameo on bass from punk legend Jar Wobble.
That track is still out there, you know. It is a fantastic Andrew Weatherall mix of Higher Than the Sun. I remember Weatherall calling up and saying, I want to ask Jar Wobble to play bass in this. And we were like, is that all right? And we were like, of course, he's our hero, you know. The first pieces of music that I learned playing an instrument were two things. On guitar, the two-note boredom solo by Buzz Cox. And then Jar Wobble's Public Image Limited bass lines. And Peter Hook's Joy Division bass lines. And so, yeah, we were flattered that Jar Wobble would want to play in a Primal Scream track. And yeah, it's pretty, it's experimental. It's out there, you know. It's pretty psychedelic. And we were actually supposed to play a version of Higher Than the Sun with Jar Wobble at the Empire Ballroom, Leicester Square. I think it was July 1991. And before we set out on the tour, Martin Duffy, Robert Young, myself and Andrew Ennis, we jammed with Wobble up at the rehearsal rooms off Caledonia Road. And it was incredible. We jammed for like a couple of hours. In the end, it never happened because the bass player we had at the time, Henry Olsen, freaked out on the day of the gig. I wish we'd handled it better. We never handled it very well. And then it never worked out. And Jar was, he was upset, and he was right to be upset, you know, and I had to apologise to him and stuff. So that was bad, you know. We'd been up all night, played a gig in Bristol, went to do a sound check at like 10 in the morning, so nobody'd been asleep. It was right at the end of the tour, so everybody was a bit fuzzy and a bit, you know, mentally dislocated, and we made the wrong decision. I think Wobble turned up for the sound check, and he was told that he wasn't needed, so that was really, he was upset, and he was right to be upset, and I spoke to him after, and actually his manager, I had to call his manager, and his manager let me have it, and I had to just sit there and take it. Then I had to call Wobble, which was, you know, call one of my heroes, my teenage heroes, and he was upset, but he was cool, you know. And since then, everything's been great, you know. Whenever I see him, he gives us a big hug, and you know, he's a brilliant guy, and he's still one of my heroes. And yeah, we just handled it wrong, you know. I knew quite early on that people were being affected by it very intensely, and that I remember this couple coming up to me in the Zap Club. And they had said that they just had, this is quite soon after the record had been released, and they said that they'd had their kid, they'd had a child, recently had a child, and they'd had, the baby had been born at Screamadelica, you know. I was thinking, whoa, crazy. And then, you know, over the years, people would tell us that they'd buried their friends to like a track in Screamadelica, or I think Alan McGee's daughter was born to Inner Flight, I think. So I'm happy and always thankful and humbled by people's love for the record, and I think it's an amazing thing, you know. It's nice, you know. It's great sometimes you walk into the record store and you see Nevermind the Bollocks, Screamadelica, Transformer, Ziggy Stardust, and I think, hey, that's pretty cool. Maybe it captured the times. Maybe we were the times, you know. We were out every night. We were, you know, that was our life. Music was our life. Going to clubs was our life. But really, we were, you know, young artists, and we were sincerely living. We were living in the moment, and we were sincere about what we were doing. And we loved going to the clubs. We loved music. We were fanatical record collectors. And we really believed in rock and roll, and we really believed that we wanted to redeem rock and roll and let it be contemporary, modern. And we just thought it was stuck in the past, and it had lost everything that made it attractive in the first place, like sex, subversion, style, you know, rhythm. I honestly think that the Acid House moment was a moment of possibility. It's a moment of possibilities, and it was a crack in the sky. It was a little bit of light getting through the darkness of Thatcherism. And if you remember the 80s, it was a dark time. You know, Thatcher, threat of nuclear war, you know, continual endless Tory governments, repression, deregulation. Acid House was political, and it was a communal thing. It wasn't elitist. It was about bringing people together, and it was about a celebration of life and a bit brotherhood. And I think that, and sisterhood, and I think that, as I say, it was a time of possibility. It was a time of where people, just like during the punk times, they were inspired to believe in themselves and realise that they could be creative people and they could make a difference in this world. And if you come together with other people, you can, great things can be achieved. And I honestly think that we lived that life, and you can hear it in the music that it was, I think the times, the possibilities of those times are in that record. And it's an up record. It's also quite a sad record. And it's an emotional record. It's full of feeling, but it's joyous, but it's also like a, you know, and I think that that had been lost in rock and roll, that sense of joy and rebellion, you know, and it's in there, you know.
Our thanks to Bobby Gillespie for revisiting Screamadelica. I'm Mark Goodyear. You've been listening to Classic Album Club.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.